From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ernest Hemingway was born 100 years ago today. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with A.E. Hotchner, who worked closely with Hemingway and was also a good friend during the last 14 years of Hemingway's life. 5 years after his death, Hotchner wrote a memoir about him. It's just been republished. Hotchner will share some of his memories of Hemingway, including the depression and paranoia that preceded his suicide. And of course, we'll talk about his work and the impact it's had on American writing. We commemorate Hemingway's centennial on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Navy divers have located the bodies of John F. Kennedy Jr., his wife Carolyn, and her sister Lauren Bessette. Senator Edward Kennedy and his sons, Patrick and Edward Jr., traveled to the Navy salvage vessel 7.5 miles off Martha's Vineyard to identify the bodies. Officials say underwater cameras spotted the fuselage of Kennedy's plane last night, with Kennedy's body still aboard. It's not clear yet where the bodies of the two sisters were in relation to the wreckage. In New York City, mourners are leaving tributes at the apartment building where John Kennedy and his wife lived. Carrie Nolan reports from member station WNYC.
The entrance to the Kennedys' downtown Manhattan loft is covered with bouquets, stuffed animals, candles, and notes of condolence. Police have been making sure the small side street in the area called Tribeca is not overrun, and the crowds move along police barricades. It's reported the toys and flowers will be distributed to area children's hospitals. Some mourners have said the discovery of Kennedy's remains brings some sense of closure to their grief. Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg emerged briefly from her Long Island home today. She went for a bike ride with her husband and did not speak to reporters. An Irish immigrant organization will hold a memorial Thursday evening. No word yet from the Kennedy family regarding funeral arrangements. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Nolan. In New York.
At his news conference today, President Clinton acknowledged that the Coast Guard searched for the Kennedy plane longer than they would have searched for an ordinary citizen's plane. The president said he ordered the search to continue because the Coast Guard believed the search would be successful and because of the Kennedy family's contributions to the nation. As Republicans get ready to vote on their tax cut plan, the president renewed his attacks on the proposal and repeated his threat to veto the bill. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The longer it takes the Republicans in the House to assemble the votes they need to pass their $792 billion tax cut, the more time the president has to criticize it. Today he said the GOP plan would put the nation's fiscal health at risk and jeopardize the solvency of Medicare and Social Security.
I hope we can still work together across party lines to save Social Security and Medicare, to safeguard our priorities, and have the right kind of tax cut. If Congress passes the wrong kind, of course I will not sign it. I will not allow a risky plan to become law.
The president says his own $250 billion tax cut would pay off the federal debt, extend the solvency of Medicare and Social Security, and provide more money for education and defense. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Stock prices rose today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 7 points to close at 11,003. Advances edged declines in active trading. This is NPR News. General Motors has agreed to recall more than 3 million pickup trucks, SUVs, and vans because of potential problems with anti-lock braking systems. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
There are actually two different recalls here, and only the first is classified as a safety recall. It involves 1.1 million GM pickups and SUVs built from 1991 through 96. All are four-wheel drive. The problem involves a sensor which makes the anti-lock brakes think the vehicle is in four-wheel drive mode when it's actually in two-wheel drive. It can result in extended braking distances. The other action is being called a service recall by federal safety regulators. It, too, involves ABS systems on GM trucks built in the 1990s. No deaths have resulted from the problems, though there have been accidents and several hundred injuries. Federal officials say they've been studying the vehicles for the past 5 years. GM will notify affected vehicle owners. Don Gagne, NPR News, Detroit.
The World Bank warned Indonesia today that donor nations would change their plans to lend Indonesia money if anything happens to disrupt a UN-sponsored election in East Timor. Donors for Indonesia are scheduled to meet in Paris next week, and they're expected to pledge as much as $6 billion to help Indonesia meet its budget for the current fiscal year. Indonesia has agreed to hold a UN-supervised independence referendum for East Timor in August, but pro-Indonesian military groups have been accused of trying to intimidate Timorese voters with murders, kidnappings, and other terror tactics. On Wall Street, the Nasdaq gained 29 points to close at 2,762. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ernest Hemingway was born 100 years ago today. As my guest A.E. Hotchner writes, the name Hemingway conjures up a man of courage and daring, both in his writing and in his way of life. Both of these changed A.E. Hotchner's life. The two men first met in a professional capacity in 1948, when Hotchner was sent to Cuba by Cosmopolitan magazine to ask Hemingway to write a piece about the future of literature. With Hemingway's blessing, Hotchner went on to adapt several Hemingway works for CBS TV, including The Snows of Kilimanjaro and For Whom the Bell Tolls. Hotchner and Hemingway remained friends until Hemingway's suicide in 1961. 5 years later, Hotchner wrote a memoir about him called Papa Hemingway. A new edition of this book has just been published with a new preface. A.E. Hotchner, welcome to Fresh Air.
Glad to see you.
Now, you explain in your new edition that Mary, who was Hemingway's fourth and last wife, tried to stop publication of your memoir back in the mid-60s. What was her objection to it?
Well, she tried to get an injunction against it. Her objection was, fundamentally, that the last chapters of the book dealt with his decline in the last couple of years of his life, mentally and physically, and how it affected his will to live, and resulted in the fact that two or three times he attempted suicide and finally succeeded in it. It was Mary's story at that time of the event of that morning, that terrible morning when his head was blown off, that he had been cleaning his rifle and that he had forgotten that the chamber was loaded and accidentally he had committed this terrible act. She frankly said, if you will remove the last three chapters, I withdraw the lawsuit. I said, of course not. I mean, that's just such a travesty that this man who was such a great hunter, why would he be cleaning his gun the beginning of July? And he who was a stickler for protocol, how could he possibly leave the cartridges in the chamber?
Oh, and he had a whole creed about honesty in writing.
Of course.
Why should you lie?
So why? And that was really the genesis of the lawsuit. And then she had another very peculiar original thought about what belongs to a writer. She said that my use of dialogue, in which I quote Hemingway talking to me, in the book, I recreated some of what we said to each other. She said, you know, when a writer talks, his words are his. And so even his verbal words spoken out into the air are copyrighted. So that was a contention that the Court of Appeals threw out in a hurry.
So it actually did go to court.
Oh, yeah. She took it into the Supreme Court of New York, which is the trial court, and it was decided against her there. And then she took it to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals quickly affirmed the finding of the lower court, and that was the end of that. But it was a regrettable incident.
Now, what did you understand about the depression that led to his suicide? Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you thought he was going through at that time.
I think it was a combination, probably, of first, a physical deterioration, and that when he began to lose physical prowess, physical powers. I think it affected some of his thinking. I think basically, if I had to sum up what the problem was, Ernest was only 62 years old at the time of his death. He certainly looked like a man and acted like a man and reacted to his living demands like a man in his late 80s. And I've often thought, I think that in Ernest's case, he had this marvelous bank of energy and creativity, and he chose to use it all up early and had nothing left. And I think that he had just burned himself out to the point where, as he said, if he can't live in the manner which he had lived, he didn't want to live anymore.
He had also gotten delusional, and you knew him very well during this phase. He thought that people were following him, that federal agents were following, that his phones were tapped, that his mail was being intercepted. What was it like to know him through this delusional period?
Frightening. But it was gradual, you understand. It didn't just happen overnight. The first time that I really got spooked about the whole aspect of what was happening to him, he was in Madrid. He had gone to Madrid to research photographs for what became A Dangerous Summer, which was the last of the books that he authorized to be published. I came over because I had undertaken to help him cut his big manuscript into three installments for Life magazine. He had accumulated a lot of photographs and other materials, research materials, that he wanted to bring back with him. And for that, he had bought another little suitcase. He became concerned whether he could fly Iberia with this additional suitcase. Mm-hmm. And at first I said, well, of course you can. You're allowed two or three suitcases. You only have one. It's permissible. No, he said, I don't think it is. And I can't get turned away at the gate. And he began to be very disturbed about this. Finally, he said, I want to know the weight of it. I want a bellhop, we were in the Palace Hotel, to take the suitcases and weigh them for me so I can tell them the weight. At that point, my blood really chilled because I knew that he no longer was rational.
Right.
About a lot of things. There'd been little signs, and of course we did have to have they weighed it. He'd had to have assurance in writing from the airline that they would take the suitcases. And from then on, there was just one irrational fear after another.
Now, although a lot of what he was experiencing was delusional, like that his mail was being intercepted and that people were following him, I think you eventually got his Freedom of Information Act files.
Yeah, that
files,
was, that gave me a terrible
files.
Start. Because I'd always felt that all of this delusional material about that J. Edgar Hoover had it in for him, that there was a file on him, that federal agents were following him, that his, when I went to see him at the Mayo Clinic, where he was kept there for electric shock treatments, he wouldn't talk to me in his hospital room. We had to go out to my rented car and drive to a place nearby in the park where we talked.
He thought the room was bugged.
He thought the room was bugged. Well, I got the Freedom of Information Act later, many years later, and indeed, the phone outside his hall was bugged. And indeed, J. Edgar Hoover had a file, and indeed, he was being processed by the FBI. So that part of his delusion was not delusional. It was just intensified. It wasn't as bad as he thought, but he did have an insight into what was happening.
Well, you're part of the reason why he ended up institutional. I guess this came out wrong. You're part of the reason he ended up institutional. I didn't mean you were driving him mad. But you encouraged Mary to put him in a hospital, and I think you helped create the story that, well, your blood pressure is really high, and we need to check you out in a hospital, because I think you were afraid to tell him.
We had a problem with Ernest in that where he should have gone was the Menninger Clinic, but then that would be out and out psychiatric. We knew that he would resist that. He had attempted suicide at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary talked to me about this, and I said, I think we need some guidance. So I went to see New York analyst psychiatrist whom I knew, and he conversed with George Saviors, who was the doctor in Idaho, who the internist who was treating him. And it was decided that the only way that we could get him to get any kind of psychiatric help would be to tell him that his blood pressure was too high and to suggest that he go to the Mayo Clinic to have it checked. And that's how we got him to go there. But again, it was a frightening journey because a small plane took him there, but it had to stop to refuel. And while we stopped to refuel halfway there, he tried to walk into the moving propellers of the plane.
Oh, God.
And then when we took off, and it was averted by the pilot's quick action when he saw this, we took off, and he tried to open the door and jump out. So we were dealing with a frightening aspect of Ernest trying to kill himself.
Well, he had electroshock therapy as part of
but that was therapy. That was another sad development. As good as the Mayo Clinic then was for medicine, it was inadequate in terms of psychiatric treatment. They just formed the division. I'm not talking about them today. I only know what happened back there in 1961. They were supposed to give him a series of electric shock treatments. I think, I could be wrong about this, I think there were 21 in that series. They only gave him half of it at the time that they let him go back to Ketchum, which according to the doctor in New York, Cattell was his name, whom I was consulting, he called angrily the doctors there and said, that's worse than not having given him any because it's not completing the cycle leaves him in a really deteriorated state.
Very agitated.
Very agitated. And, of course, it led to his, again, trying to kill himself.
Now, he was losing his memory in part as a result of the shock therapy, and that was very upsetting
to him.
The
worst part was, the first time I went to the Mayo Clinic, Kennedy was being inaugurated, and he had sent a telegram to Ernest inviting him to be in his box as an honored guest. And, of course, Ernest was in no condition to go. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to write a declination in a proper way to him. And he just couldn't get the words to come out. Right. This man who always wrote effortlessly. So that, again, was a torture. As it was, he was trying to finish what became a movable feast. He had to write the last sentence. And for the next 3 months, he couldn't write the last sentence.
Now, you say in your book, you said to him, look, you know, you've gone 10 years in between books in the past.
Right.
I know you can't write now. If you could go 10 years in the past without writing, why can't you just relax a little bit now during this period when you have trouble writing and just wait it out?
I said, you wanted to fish some of the great waters of the world. He was a great fisherman, loved fishing. I said, well, why don't you go to Peru or wherever these marlins or whatever it is you want to fish for are, and enjoy yourself, and give up the thought that you have to turn out something at this moment, because between For Whom the Bell Tolls and Across the River, 10 years had passed. But he said, any day that I think I can't write, I can't live. Those 10 years, I knew any one of those days I could write, and that was the difference.
I'm wondering if you think that his drinking in the past masked depressions. You know,
this business of alcoholism, when it becomes more than just drinking, it's very hard to assess that. I was with him so often on trips, long trips. We spent an entire summer in Spain following the two bullfighters, Dominguín and Antonio Ordóñez, during which time Ernest would drink wine. I never felt that he was drinking excessively. He had stopped drinking any hard liquor. We traveled around in an old Ford that he had rented, and Bill Davis drove it. And he decided we should go down to Gibraltar, where he bought an entire wheel of Parmesan cheese. Now, a wheel is the size of a wheel on a car.
That's a lot of cheese.
So the way we traveled was, I sat in the back seat with the wheel next to me over this hot Spanish summer, and Ernest sat up front with Bill. He had a wine bag, and sometimes in the afternoon, he would say, shave some of that, Hotch, and then he would drink some wine. Looking back on that summer, I would say there was really no sign of what you would call alcoholism. I never saw Ernest in any way affected by alcohol. And yet, there persists today with this gushet of articles and books about Hemingway today, especially now in this centenary year, there is a perception that he was an alcoholic But you see, that drinking, yes, it probably was something that was part of his living experience, but he'd been drinking like that since he was a young man, you know. That was his answer. He said, you know, that's just part of my life. I always have a few drinks.
But he had to stop drinking for his health at some point, and that
well,
was
after the
a
war,
big change
after the
for
crashes
him.
In Africa, mm-hmm. I was with him. We drove from Venice. He'd come back from Africa on a slow boat. He was beat up. His back was hurt. He was quite wounded in the hurt in the second crash, not the first.
What year was this?
54. Mm-hmm. When we got to Spain, there was a doctor there, a very well-known doctor, Medina Vecchia, I think you pronounce it. He had known Ernest since the Spanish Civil War, when Ernest was a war correspondent. And he ran a lot of tests. At that point, he said, Ernest, you've got to now go on a diet, and you've got to cut down the drinking. You can have 2 glasses of wine a day. And he religiously followed that. As a matter mm-hmm. of fact, he watered the wine, even the 2 glasses, with water. Yeah. There was a great concern about his health, his concern. And certainly those last years, there was almost no drinking at all.
My guest is A.E. Hotchner. He worked with Hemingway and was a close friend during the last 14 years of Hemingway's life. Hotchner's memoir about him, Papa Hemingway, has just been republished. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is A.E. Hotchner, and his 1965 memoir about Ernest Hemingway has just been published in a new Hemingway Centennial edition with a new preface. Let's talk about how you first met. It was 1948. You were in your 20s.
Yep.
You were sent down by Cosmopolitan magazine to Hemingway's home in Cuba to commission him to write, well, to invite him to write a piece for the magazine about the future of literature. You say you felt like a horse's ass going down to make him that offer. Why did you feel that way?
Well, I mean, that was such an asinine assignment. But at that point, Cosmopolitan was a literary magazine before Helen Gurley Brown got hold of it and turned it into a Sex for the Single Girl magazine. Hemingway had written for the magazine before. As a matter of fact, I think one of the sections of To Have and Have Not had been published in Cosmopolitan. They wanted to run a series on the future of everything. The future of the automobile, written by Henry Ford II or whatever. And literature was to be earnest. So I felt, what a dumb thing to do. Also, I'd been in awe of him since high school, reading his books. You know, he was somebody that I didn't want to approach no matter what. Mm-hmm. I was in awe of him. So I simply sent a note out to his place in San Francisco to Paula saying, I'm down here on this ridiculous assignment. Could you just scribble something that says, get lost or something like that, so I can go back and show that I contacted you? And to my absolute amazement, the next morning, the phone rang, and Hotchner, this is Hemingstein here. I can't let you get kicked out of your job by the Hearst people. That's like if you're a leper getting kicked out of the colony. So I'll meet you at the Floridita for a drink, 5 o'clock. And that's how I met Hemingway. And we did have several papadobles, which is a drink that was invented for him. It's really a frozen daiquiri, but of a sort of served in a vase big enough for long-stem roses. And from that point on, he took me out in the boat, and we hit it off just fine. And he did write something for Cosmopolitan, but what it developed into, instead of a short story, it became Across the River and Into the Trees, which is a novel that was published in 3 installments.
It seems to me several times in the early part of your relationship, he put you in an awkward position where he wasn't meeting a deadline and he was at the same time asking for more money to complete the piece. So you'd have to go back to the publisher or the editor and say, well, he doesn't have the piece and he wants more money. And you couldn't tell for sure if he'd ever really deliver the goods. Wasn't that an awkward position to be in?
It was... I'll tell you what he was doing in the case of Across the River, for example. He was about to take off with Mary, his wife. I think they were going on the Ile de France. I don't remember what boat. But he was going to Paris, and then he was going to go to Venice, and he was going to check up on stuff that was in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And he was at the Sherry Netherlands Hotel at the Point, and we were having an evening in his suite with Marlene Dietrich and other friends of his. And he looked at me and he said, "Well, Hotch, you should be going on this trip." He said, "Why don't you do this? You go back and tell the editor." By then, my friend was no longer the editor, but a man that I wasn't very friendly with was the editor. He said, here's the manuscript, but you don't have the last two chapters," which he removed. And he said, "Just tell him you don't have the last two chapters." So I went back, and I said, "Here it is, all is, but we don't have the last two chapters. Well, how can we begin publication? You stick with them until you get the two chapters." So I went back to the Sherry Netherlands. I walked in, as I walked through the door, he said, "When are you leaving?"
That's great. Nate, you say in your memoir that you were struck with an affliction common to your generation, Hemingway awe. Do you think Hemingway ever took advantage of that, knowing how in awe you were of him?
Oh, I don't think he ever took advantage of that. There is this perception that Hemingway was boastful and a braggart and self-promoter. That we read all that and hear all that today by people who didn't know him. The books being written are by people who not only didn't know him, but they don't have access to people who knew him because almost all of them are dead, all of the relatives and everybody else. And even family didn't see much of him. He was not much of a family man, even for his sons. The last 10, 15 years of his life, he didn't see much of them.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this perception that he was promoting what people read at that time in the gossip columns and everything else. The fact is that they were promoting it. So you'd get people like the columnists of the day, Walter Winchell and Earl Wilson and Leonard Lyons. They had, at that time, those columns were very influential. They appeared in hundreds and hundreds of newspapers. And all of them were magnifying whatever he did. If he went on a safari and he killed a lion, well, he killed a dozen lions. Everything was magnified. And the fact that he was doing things that nobody had done before, the bullfight was virtually discovered by him, mm-hmm. for those who weren't Spanish, and so forth. And so those exploits made people think that he was promoting himself. It wasn't that. It's that he genuinely felt a kinship with what was happening in the bull ring. And he genuinely felt something that you will get from Macomber and a few of his stories, something about the hunt in Africa that was quite different perception than what one would get out of it.
A.E. Hotchner is the author of the memoir Papa Hemingway, which has just been republished. Hotchner will be back in the second half of the show. Our interview was also recorded by C-SPAN 2. It will be shown as part of their Book TV Hemingway special this Sunday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Bantam Books, publishers of War of the Rats by David L. Robbins, a novel about the World War II battle in Stalingrad. Available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on the life and writing of Ernest Hemingway. We continue our conversation with A.E. Hotchner, author of the memoir Papa Hemingway, which has just been republished.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ernest Hemingway was born 100 years ago today. My guest, A.E. Hotchner, worked with Hemingway and was a close friend during the last 14 years of Hemingway's life. 5 years after Hemingway's suicide, Hotchner wrote a memoir about him called Papa Hemingway. It's just been republished with a new preface. Now, you did several TV adaptations of his work for CBS.
For Playhouse 90, yes.
Now, Buick, I understand, wanted you to write happy endings to A Farewell to Arms and The Sun Also Rises and to Heaven Have Not. What was your reaction? I think they offered you a free car for the,
yeah, they offered
the happy
me.
Endings.
That's right. They said, you know, are you interested in ratings? Because it's a series, and if people feel that they have these down endings, they won't come back for the next one. And I said, well, it's amazing how Mr. Shakespeare was able to survive all those bad endings. I haven't seen any rewrites of the end of Macbeth or any of the other plays, and I don't think really that you would like Catherine, instead of dying in childbirth in A Farewell to Arms, suddenly to recover at the last second.
I feel good again.
Yeah, and the squealing little Catherine Jr. come Papa. Galloping out of her womb. So, I simply laughed them off of off of that. I can see the Jake Barnes at the end. Suddenly, there sprouts this heretofore not present penis, and we are in business.
So, but they didn't fire you?
No, they didn't fire me. No, they couldn't because they had signed me to a contract. That was a big mistake.
So, did Hemingway offer you advice about how to adapt his language and dialogue on the page into a television adaptation?
But this all started because people began appearing down in Cuba at his place, trying to get rights to this, that, and the other thing. And he said, you do me a great favor. Could you, you're up there in New York, could I refer them to you? And if it's something that you think is interesting, to let me know. That's how I really started this, because I had done no television and I didn't really know anything about writing for television. So that when Fred Coe came to me, he was a producer at the time of Quality Things, and he said, we want to do something of Hemingway's on Playwrights 56, which was opposite the 60,000, whatever that quiz show was. I said, well, everything that's any good that could be done in that length of an hour has really been sold, you know, Kilimanjaro and Macumber and all the stories. Well, he said, well, what is it that you like that you think might make something dramatic? I said, well, I like a story called The Battler, but it's four or five pages, and I don't know how you get an hour out of it. So would you ask Mr. Hemingway if that would be available? So I called him, and he said, I'll do it if you'll adapt it. And I said, I can't adapt it. I know anything about television. He said, oh, yeah, you do it. And I said, well, you know, I'll try it and show it to you. No, he said, and this is to answer your question. No, he said, don't ever show me anything.
Oh. Yeah.
I'm going to trust you until you do something that's really rotten. And so because of that, he never really participated in the creation of it. However, when I did things like The Gambler, The Nun, and The Radio, which was a short story of his, which had holes in it that I couldn't fill in, and I asked him about that, then he wrote me. I have a couple of letters from him, in which he told me the background of the people who were in the hospital. It's a story about himself but it's masked. But that was the extent. But the funniest thing that happened was when we did for him The Bell Tolls with Jason Robards and Maria Schell and Eli Wallach, Maureen Stapleton, whatever.
Good cast.
It was in two parts. It was obviously taped. We were driving, Ernest and Mary and myself, I was the driver, from Ketchum to Key West. And when we were going across the Texas plains somewhere, Ernest said, this is the night that the second part's on. I nearly fell over because I didn't think he was keeping any
right.
track. So he stopped at some flea-bitten little motel and went into the lobby and said to the innkeeper, who nearly fainted when he saw who it was, he said, listen, something I want to see on television. And the fellow said, well, we only have this one big television down in the lobby. We don't have television in the rooms. Well, he said, do you think you could bring it upstairs? So they carted this up to his room, It was one of those televisions that had rabbit ears that didn't have an antenna outside. We couldn't get any reception except if you held the rabbit ear. So get this picture. We're in this motel room. Ernest and Mary propped themselves up, pillows, with their backs on the bed. And the television set, this big old lumbering television set, was in front of them. And I had to sit next to it holding the rabbit ears. Afterwards, he went to the phone and called Maria and called Jason and told him how terrific he thought it was. He was very considerate that way. He really was very generous mm-hmm. With other writers. If they weren't Faulkner, whom we'd never be generous with, that was a
jealous.
That was a real warfare there.
Well, you have been a very careful Hemingway reader. You loved Hemingway's writing long mm-hmm. before you met him. And then you had to reread him very carefully because you were adapting his work. I asked you to just choose a few lines of Hemingway's writing that you think are very Hemingway and talk about what you think they say, what they reveal about Hemingway's style. What do you want to read for us?
I'm going to read the very opening of A Farewell to Arms. This is as much Hemingway's style as anything mm-hmm. of Hemingway's. In the late summer of that year, we lived in a house in a village that looked across the river and the plain to the mountains. In the bed of the river, there were pebbles and boulders, dry and white in the sun, and the water was clear and swiftly moving and blue in the channels. Troops went by the house and down the road, and the dust they raised powdered the leaves of the trees. The trunks of the trees, too, were dusty, and the leaves fell early that year, and we saw the troops marching along the road, and the dust rising, and leaves, stirred by the breeze, falling, and the soldiers marching, and afterwards the road bare and white, except for the leaves.
Now, what's quintessential Hemingway about that?
Notice the simplicity of the language that's used, and the almost poetic repetition. It's almost as if it's poetry. You could scan that, I'll bet, and you would find that it has a scan to it. But the realism of it, when I first read that, I could feel the autumn in the air. I could feel leaves falling, and there was a brook rushing outside. He transports you into the area with a minimum of description so that you furnish some of the description. That's the great gift that he had, that he brought to American literature. That was his skill. That was the spareness. I once said to him, how do you ever feel? How do you ever react to the fact that you're being lionized on universities all over the country as having brought a new style to American writing? And he said, I didn't consciously bring anything. He said, I just write prose in an awkward way, in my own awkward way. And my awkwardness is what they see as style. But he said, there is no conscious effort to create any style. If there were, it would be phony. I just write as it comes out of me, as spare and as knowingly and as directly as I can.
My guest is A.E. Hotchner, who worked with Hemingway and was a close friend during the last 14 years of Hemingway's life. His memoir, Papa Hemingway, has just been republished. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is A.E. Hotchner, and he knew Hemingway for about the last 14 years of Hemingway's life. They were friends and professional associates. And Hotchner's 1965 memoir about Hemingway has just been published in a new Hemingway Centennial Edition with a new preface. It's called Papa Hemingway. At some point, you asked Hemingway if you should do like he did and move to Paris to test yourself, to see if you could be, you know, if you could write a great novel there. And what advice did Hemingway give you?
He said, you know, nobody knows what is in him, if anything, until he gives it a try. So one of two things can happen. You can find to your benefit that you have good stuff in you and that what comes out is something that you can be proud of, you can deal with, so forth. But, he said, you run the risk that there may be nothing in you or what's in you is inadequate and what's in you will be a big disappointment to you. And it could very well crack you for the rest of your life. So that's your risk. I mean, it's a gamble. So if you go there thinking that you've got the right stuff and you haven't, then how are you going to deal with it? And if you have, then how are you going to deal with it?
So did you stay home after that?
I went.
You went?
Oh, yeah. I've always felt that the only thing that you have to regret are the things you didn't do.
Now, he gave you more advice about Paris, which led to you providing the title for his memoir about Paris in the 20s.
Well,
what
he said,
did he say to you?
If you go to Paris as a young man and you live in Paris, wherever you go for the rest of your life, Paris is a movable feast. And he's right about that. Paris has been that to me as it was to him.
Hemingway had a lot of interesting things to say about writing, and I thought I'd read one of those things, and this is from his posthumously published book, A Movable Feast, which you gave the title to. And this is about trying to write in the 20s. And he says, when he's in Paris, and he says, I would stand and look out over the roofs of Paris and think, do not worry, you have always written before and you will write now. All you have to do is write one true sentence, write the truest sentence that you know. So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. It was easy then because there was always one true sentence that I knew or had seen or had heard someone say. If I started to write elaborately or like someone introducing or presenting something, I found that I could cut that scroll work or ornament out and throw it away and start with the first true simple declarative sentence I had written. I like the idea of throwing away the ornamentation and realizing when he was sounding too presentational. Did you get a sense of that ever from observing him write or hearing him talk about that?
He told me that he really picked up on that business of editing out from Gertrude Stein, because he had had an introduction to her and her salon from Sherwin Anderson had given a letter of introduction. And he had subsequently shown her one of his stories. They weren't selling and they were all being rejected. And she had said, Hemingway, take this back and just remove all of the varies that are in there, the word very. Don't use any of the very, not very late or very beautiful. Take all the varies out. So he said, I picked the varies like you pick berries. I picked the varies. And he said, and it strengthened it a lot. And then Scott Fitzgerald, in the story 50 Grand, which was one of the first stories that he sent to Maxwell Perkins for him, he said, Hemingway, you don't need the first paragraph. Cut it out. And he said, I learned from those early experiences, the more you leave out, the stronger you can get. If what you've got is substance and you just want to trim away all the curlicues that don't mean anything. So I think that he had good teachers along the way.
I think there are a lot of contrasts and contradictions in Hemingway's character. And I mean, for example, I mean, what he's famous for in his writing and in the way he lived his life is in part that kind of macho, you know, the hunt, the bullfight, being, you know, reporting on wars, being an ambulance driver in World War I. At the same time, he was really a kind of romantic in his writing, and that seems like a bit of a contradiction, the macho and the romantic. What do you think?
Well, this whole business of the macho, if you really analyze the books, the main books, in Sun Also Rises, we have a hero who can't function as a man. So, and in the end, he tragically has to go off away from the woman he loves. In Farewell to Arms, we have a hero who deserts from his unit in the First World War and has a woman whom he loves, who, by the way, is very well drawn. Hemingway's often criticized that he doesn't write women very well, but indeed he does. Lady Brett in The Sun Also Rises, and Catherine in Anyway, So what is the end of A Farewell to Arms is not a macho ending at all. It's a man who loses this woman and child. And alone, he walks back to the hotel in the rain. These are very down endings. The Old Man and the Sea is anything but a macho book.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that he's been misunderstood in that respect.
One of the most famous war injuries in literature is in The Sun Also Rises,
right,
where the main character, Jake Barnes, has had his penis blown off.
Yeah.
And is unable to make love and therefore to consummate the relationship with the woman he loves. What did Hemingway tell you that character's injury was based on?
I think it was based probably on his own injury when he, as an 18-year-old volunteer ambulance driver in the Italian War, suffered a grievous wound in his leg. His knee was really blown off in a trench, and he had to recuperate in the hospital in Milan, where he met Agnes von Kieraski, whom he had an affair with in the hospital. I think that was a searing event, and I think he simply transferred that terrible wound to Jake Barnes, a private part. But I think he realized what that would mean, and I think that was a playoff from that. From everything that we ever discussed, I would come with that conclusion.
He told you that shortly after writing The Sun Also Rises that he was unable to make love. He said he felt as if he might as well have been Jake Barnes at that point. What happened to him?
That was very funny because he had, during his marriage to Hadley, he had fallen into an affair with Pauline. And Pauline had come to visit them, and after he married Pauline there, he then found that he had this terrible impotence, which he said got transferred from having written about Jake Barnes. So he said he tried a variety of remedies, and none of it. There was one guy had electrodes that he attached to him, and he drank calf's liver juice and all that sort of calf's liver blood. And finally, Pauline suggested that maybe he should go to the local church down the street and pray. And Ernest said, well, he really felt like a damn fool praying to the Virgin Mary for an erection, but at any rate, he did this. And then he came back to the room, the little place that he had with Pauline. Pauline was in bed, and he said, and we made love like we invented it. And he said, and that's when I became a Catholic.
Did he stay a Catholic?
No. Then he always referred to himself as a failed Catholic.
A quick failure.
Yeah, right.
But a success in bed, I suppose.
Well, I think he was, at least at that time. I think later, yes, I think he always had a romantic interest. That's one of the fascinating things to me. During these times that he was married, and Ernest had to be married, he was just one of those men that had to be married. But married, he always had a romantic interest. Now, I don't mean that he had a...
You mean in somebody else?
An affair, yes. And it was always young and attractive and very often not consummated in any way, but just this romantic figure that he could call upon. I've never understood why that was so necessary to him, but I think that later, when we get into that dark, black period of his life, I think that his sexual powers all collapsed, along with his ability to eat and drink and do the things that he really wanted to do. I think that after those crashes, in one of his letters to me, I have a lot of letters from him. In one of the letters from him, he said, you know, I go out in the Pilar, that was his boat, but I can't fish because I don't have the strength to fish. It takes a lot of strength to boat a marlin or what. So given all those failures, I think that now we get to the real reason why the suicide took place. I think that it was just he could no longer be Ernest Hemingway.
He couldn't write. He couldn't make love.
Yeah.
He had no physical strength.
Yeah. And he couldn't enjoy drinking or eating or his friends. Or it all just seemed to collapse in on him, like a house when the walls and the roof all just tumble down.
My guest is A.E. Hotchner, who worked with Hemingway and was a close friend during the last 14 years of Hemingway's life. Hotchner's memoir, Papa Hemingway, has just been republished. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. A.E. Hotchner is my guest, and he was a close friend and professional associate of Ernest Hemingway's in the last 14 years of Hemingway's life. And Hotchner's 1965 memoir about Hemingway, Papa Hemingway, has just been published in a new edition with a new preface. Now, his later writing, a lot of readers believe, and I believe you think this as well, really didn't measure up to his earlier writing. Do you have any sense if he felt that way about it, too?
Well, you know, Ernest always had a great faith in his own writing. He's the only book that he wrote that had negative reviews was Across the River and Into the Trees. Mm-hmm. Everything else had been extolled by critics and by popular acclaim. He didn't accept those reviews. He felt that they didn't understand what he was trying to do. However, they knew that they had knocked him on his ass. So instead of giving up, of course, in typical Hemingway fashion, he got up off what he called the deck and wrote as a rebuttal, Old Man in the Sea. But I think that he was losing that creative power that he had so tautly in the beginning. He was certainly losing that toward the end of his life. And that's why we have those wandering manuscripts that posthumously have been scissored and pasted together and published as Islands in the Stream and Garden of Eden, and True at First Light. These books were not intended as books. They were bits and scraps of stuff that he left written then. The only two posthumously published books that he intended to publish was A Movable Feast and A Dangerous Summer. And the last year of his life, I was with him in New York when he met with Charles Scribner and Harry Bragg, who was the editor at Scribner. And the only thing they were discussing was which book should be published first. Mm-hmm. So those books he intended, but all the rest of them are just scissors and paste jobs, and I think regrettable.
When you were young and impressionable and starting off as a writer, you worked closely with Hemingway. Was it hard for you to find your own voice after spending so much time with him who had such a powerful one of his own?
Yeah, I made a terrible mistake. I mean, thinking about it at this minute, I'm embarrassed by it. I was living in Rome, and I was living very well, but I was typically running out of money. So I decided I would write what I thought was just going to be a novelette and get it published in the Saturday Evening Post or somewhere. So I wrote this account of that I thought was in a kind of a Hemingway way of a gangster who was deported from the United States and he had to go back to Italy and so forth. I don't know how it happened, but I sent it to a woman who was to be my agent later. I really didn't have much of an agent. And she sent it, instead of sending it to the Post, she sent it over to Bennett Cerf, and he published it as a book. It was called The Dangerous American. And I was truly embarrassed because it was really not me. It was me trying to be Ernest Hemingway. So I wrote him and said, I really am sorry to tell you this. This is really a lousy book, but I'm going to have to send it to you anyway. So I didn't hear from him for a while. And when he did write me, He said, well, you were certainly right. It's a lousy book. And maybe from now on you'll write your own way and about things that you're interested in. And then he told me why. He said, well, there were a couple of things. The fight scene's good, but he said, all that stuff at the gritty hotel. And he just, you know, gave me hell. And then the next paragraph, he went on to other things. And that's it. I was forgiven for my transgression. That's okay. You got to grow out of that. But from then on, I certainly never tried to write like Ernest.
We just have a couple of seconds left. Your memoir is called Papa Hemingway. Did you call him Papa?
I called him Papa.
How did that feel?
Well, I didn't for a while, but he called himself Papa. You know, he would write, he would sign his letters Papa. And he began calling himself Papa, you know, when he was a young man. It was not something. So I didn't have much of a relationship with my own father. And it was an easy transference because his attitude toward me was that of father to son. He taught me all the things I knew about fishing and hunting and traveling and wines and foods and what oysters were good and almost everything that I came to prize later on I learned from Ernest. So it was an easy transition.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure to hear you speak. Thank you.
Thank you.
A.E. Hotchner's memoir, Papa Hemingway, has just been republished with a new preface. Hotchner is also the author of the book King of the Hill. C-SPAN 2 came to our studio to record the Hemingway interview. They'll feature it this weekend as part of their Book TV Hemingway Centennial Special. The interview will be shown Sunday at 12:45 p.m. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Kathy Wolf, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. I'm Terry Gross.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374. Fresh Air is also available online at audible.com/freshair. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Miracle of Castel di Sangro by Joe McGinnis, in hardcover wherever books are sold. And from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Life of Birds by David Attenborough, a companion to the 10-part TV series airing now on PBS, in bookstores or on the web at pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Margaret Cho. Her new one-woman show, I'm the One That I Want, is about starring in the first sitcom about an Asian-American family. She describes the experience as my journey to hell and back. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.